This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis, and today we're off to the Ventura County Fair. The promoters call it a country fair with ocean air. And like most fairs, there are carnival rides and corn dogs, farm animals and exhibits, a quilting contest, and today you are in for a real treat as we check out the Home Arts Department for the annual table setting competition. Yeah, you heard that right. Welcome to competitive table setting.
And in the box, Lindsay, are all of the little trays that go on the...
I'm not a competitive person normally. I don't think so. Maybe I am. But for me, it's all about winning.
Now that's Erin Feiss.
I am 45 years old. I am from Ventura, California, born and raised. So I've been competing since 2010, but I've only participated in 8 table settings. I missed a year.
It's 8:30 in the morning, and we're in the center of a large, echoey pavilion at the Ventura County Fairgrounds. Everywhere you turn, there's a craft of some kind on display, from jars of jam and baked goods to potholders, quilts, and mosaics. And next to many of those items are various colored prize ribbons. First, fourth place, what have you. But by far the fiercest competition in the Home Arts Department is the table setting contest. And today, Erin has her game face on. Starting in just a little while, 5 teams will have 1 hour to transform a square dinner table into an Emily Post approved work of art. Original, functional, and fitting the theme of the year. And Erin's friend, reporter Erica Gerard, is following along as she tries to bring home a first prize ribbon for table setting.
This year's theme is high tea.
I thought, well, it's Ventura, and so it would be high tea by the sea. So that's what I did. I went beachy, but I went like Hamptons beachy, not like Sandcastle beachy.
Right now, the competition is getting underway, kicked off by 78-year-old Barbara Smith, who is moderating the event. She's like a referee. She's been coming to table setting at the fair for more than 70 years now.
I always have favorites, but I try not to let my preference show. And if somebody asks me something, I tell them the best I can and then let it go.
But for Erin, being just one of the favorites isn't good enough. She's been preparing since the day the theme was announced 3 months ago, and she's here to win.
It needs to be looser. It's a little tight feeling.
I'm just going nuts. I'm spending like a ton of money, a ton of time, and it has to be like everything has to be the right thing.
The number one criteria above all others for judging table settings is adherence to the rules and guidelines. They follow the 16th edition of Emily Post's famous book. That includes exact placement of the bread plate and exact silverware for the menu. No soup, no soup spoon. Erin's hard work has paid off twice. She won the competition her very first year in 2010 and then again last year. She's also won a separate award called the People's Choice Award, which allows fairgoers to cast their vote on a favorite table.
And I have taken to calling that people's princess, just like Princess Diana, because it's the people that, like, judge you, like, which one is the best. And I've gotten people's princess a couple of times, but I've never gotten first place from the judges and people's princess at the same time. And that's what I'm going for this year. I want both.
She does something that's always 150%.
This is Erin's mom, Marty, a former competitor herself.
I did things that were much less outlandish.
She was supposed to do a canopy of palm fronds, and so we needed.
And it's just not satisfied with it just being okay. And she just has been like that from when she was a little kid.
Are the place cards inside the plastic thing?
They are, which isn't.
I'm not looking to make friends, let's just say that. And which is a crappy attitude to have at a county fair where everybody is just having a good time and it's just something you do in your spare time. And I go in there, it's the octagon for me.
Yeah, that's gonna
be an issue.
It is.
The competition's half over, 30 minutes left. Erin's high tea by the sea table is coming together.
In my
She's laying a blue and white tablecloth on top of another blue and white tablecloth with contrasting stripes. Next, she's placing a round, natural fiber placemat underneath a white, curvy dinner plate, topped with a gold appetizer plate and a blue Ikat napkin. She walks over to the seashell candelabra, fusses with the movie prop food, since the rules don't allow any real food on the table. There are fake cucumber sandwiches and pettifors, scones with whipped cream so real-looking you'd never know it was made out of spackle. Aaron's coach and cousin Lindsay stands just outside the competition area, giving notes and adjustments.
You did black, white, there's not one in the center.
Okay.
A strawberry fell.
She drove down from Northern California for 8 hours with a 2-month-old baby. This is the fifth time she's done this for Aaron.
Because it's serious. Like, it's not like a game. Like, it's a real thing. It's a competition.
Lindsay and I, my coach, my cousin, she and I work like one unit because we have prepped the day before.
And the fact that she doesn't win first place every year is, like, I think they have to give it to other people because she couldn't win every year.
Many of the table setters enter the contest year after year, but there are still fresh faces that turn out.
My name's Joanne. This is my first time, too. They had high tea table, and I like doing high teas at my house, and I thought, okay, well, I'm going to try it. And I've never done it before, so this is a new venture, and I can't believe just the beauty of each one of these. They're amazing.
Her Scottish tea table is a showcase of purple. She fluffs the center bouquet of purple and white silk flowers and straightens her purple tablecloth. The dainty white floral china pops against a purple doily underneath. A silver teapot shines in the corner, across from a whimsical ceramic cat that displays her Scottish tea menu.
Best of luck to everybody.
10 minutes to go. Erin's doing her last looks. There is one rule that Aaron breaks year after year, which is that tablecloths can only hang 18 inches over the edge of the table. The other competitors have short tablecloths that hang just over the edge. Aaron's is twice as long.
Like one for Sultan's table, for instance.
Sultan's table was the theme of a competition a few years ago.
Like, this is a Sultan. And even though the rules say that the tablecloth should only be 18 inches, I'm like, no Sultan is having an 18-inch drop on their tablecloth. It goes to the floor. That tablecloth is called a king's drape. But I get docked because it didn't adhere to the rules. But I'm like, there are some rules that I just am not going to follow.
Time's up, and here come the judges. Erin and her family head to brunch just to kill a couple hours until the final verdict is rendered.
I'm feeling a little nervous. I don't think it's going to turn out well for me, so I'm going to try to control my reaction as much as possible and not, like, overturn tables. Here's my thing. I'd either rather win first place or come in dead last.
Erin will immediately know what she placed by the color of the ribbon on her table. Blue means first place, and it's the only color that she's interested in.
Not blue. I didn't even place. I got green. I think I got fourth. The lady who did it for the first time got beginner's luck. Good for her. Good for her.
How do you really feel?
I hate this thing and never coming back. I am very bad at reading my audience here. This is the county fair. This is not Oprah's house. The People's Princess might be the one for me, which I'm okay. I would be super stoked with that. But fourth, it's like, you know what? Just tell me I'm last.
But Erin made a big mistake. She thought that a green ribbon meant fourth place, when it actually means something much worse.
I'm realizing that I didn't even get fourth place. I got honorable mention. That is a Wedgwood teapot. A legit Wedgwood teapot. Nantucket basket. They don't even know who they're messing with is on that table, and I got honorable mention. Yes, this is the big middle finger to me, which, you know what? I'm like, give me that middle finger. I'm going to take it, and I'm just going to do more next year with it. This is actually a better outcome than fourth place.
What's the word?
Mom.
What?
I got honorable mention, like a participation award.
Oh my God.
Oh
Yeah. Erin, they hate you.
They hate me, Mom. They absolutely hate me. And I'm going to take that hate and ball it up and throw it back at them next year.
I turned to Barbara, the moderator, to see if she could shed some light on why she thinks Erin lost.
The tablecloth is a little much. It's hard to sit down to. And you stand up and you hook yourself on those drapes. But, you know, that's, again, just my opinion.
Erin's coach and cousin Lindsay sees a conspiracy.
They're trying to get you out of there.
I know, and they know they should know better. I will never stop.
A few days later, Erin received the results of People's Choice. She got second. For KCRW, I'm Erica Gerard.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. John Lee appears to be the winner of the special LA City Council election in the Northwest San Fernando Valley. And the new councilman is a lot like the old one. Republican Mitch Englander vacated the 12th district seat last year in a pretty conservative part of the city. Now, Lee shares that GOP moniker and was Englander's chief of staff. He defeated the Democrat in the race, astrophysicist and community activist Lorraine Lundquist. Lee will have a lot on his agenda in the coming months, charged with, among other things, making decisions on the development and the expansion of a rapid transit bus line in the valley. And Councilman-elect Lee joins us right now. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Congratulations to you. When do you take your seat?
You know, that is a great question. We are waiting on the county registrar's office to certify the election. That could take somewhere up to 2 to 3 weeks. But I'm already working. I've been at City Hall since the mid-90s, started with Councilman Joel Wax. And that horseshoe that I will be sitting on, I hold in high regard.
That horseshoe, by the way, is going to have 14 Democrats on it, and you, the lone Republican. You're going to try and get some things done, but you're of the other political party. How do you do that?
You know, we often say that, you know, potholes don't have parties. Doesn't matter if you're a conservative or liberal. It's about, you know, taking care of your community. And I know the many of the members that sit on the council right now. And I know that we're going to be able to work together because I think we have some of the same goals. The discussion is just how to tackle those goals.
Well, some of those goals are obviously the goals that we've been talking about on this program for a long time, one of which is homelessness. Your district is the only one that hasn't approved any Triple H-funded supportive housing for the homeless. Is there anything in the works? Are you planning to do anything about that?
Well, you know, like throughout the campaign, before H and HHH, we helped build the San Fernando Valley Rescue Mission, a 90-bed shelter for those truly one paycheck away and found themselves homeless. And I'm very proud of what we've done there. We have a 93% success rate. It's a program that I think that works. But with Measure HHH funding, my community has concerns that when we start talking about $550,000 per unit, it's, when you do the math, it just doesn't add up.
Well, on your website, you have a list of ways that you say you plan to deal with homelessness. The top three items are more police patrols, the repeal of Prop 47, which is the measure that downgraded drug possession and some theft crimes to misdemeanors, and then launching a new, this is what your website says, a new and aggressive neighborhood cleanup program. That sounds like part of your plan to reduce homelessness involves putting more homeless people in jail. Is that right?
No, I think people misunderstand what I'm talking about, you know, repealing Prop 47. I look at it as there are people on our streets that are causing crimes and committing crimes to feed their drug habits. Prop 47, like you said, reduced so many felonies to misdemeanors. People to feed their drug habit can steal up to $950, not per day, but per incident, before it's considered more than a misdemeanor. We've sort of tied the hands of our police officers and our businesses are suffering because of this. We need to talk about actual rehabilitation. I'm not talking about arresting them. I'm talking about, you know, programs, rehabilitation programs that I honestly think at the end we will have people coming out of these programs thanking us for saving their lives.
Your district suffered from the Aliso Canyon gas leak, caused all kinds of problems there in Porter Ranch and other nearby places. Yet you are on the record saying you're not on board with the mayor's Green New Deal, which the mayor's office says would move L.A. toward cleaner and safer energy. What is your beef with the plan?
No, I'm all about, you know, moving towards sustainability. I just think that we need to do it in a responsible way where it doesn't affect the economy or good jobs. I have to worry about, I have a huge manufacturing zone in my district. And I know in working with those businesses over the years that on top of all the fees and the regulations and taxes that we charge these businesses to do business in LA, they rely heavily on energy. And if those energy costs go even up a little bit, let alone maybe two or three times that amount, I'm going to start losing good paying middle class jobs that I need to take into consideration. Now, Aliso Canyon being in the backyard, I live in Porter Ranch. I was affected by the blowout. My wife, my two kids, my dog even, we lived in a hotel for 4 months. I understand, you know, what happened, and I want to shut this down, but we have to do it in a responsible way.
I want to talk about transit, because Metro, LA Metro, wants to create a new, this 18-mile rapid transit bus line that would better connect the San Fernando Valley to other bus and rail lines in LA. It is a hot-button issue. Some of your constituents support it, saying those lanes will get more residents out of their cars onto public transportation, allows the buses to move a lot faster. But a lot of folks also believe that it will further congest the streets by taking away car lanes. Where do you stand?
Well, from the very beginning, I have been against putting this line on Nordhoff. I know the voters voted this in through Measure M to have a east-west bus line. But we need to start taking a look at all the options. The community feels that Nordhoff was sort of pushed onto them because of Cal State Northridge, and it was just a, you know, place there without really much outreach. Nordhoff, it's one of the most congested streets in our district. And so you're gonna start talking about pushing cars into neighborhoods, you know, with apps like Waze these days, and I don't need cars speeding through a single family, what's been a single family neighborhood for the entire 40 years that I've lived there. Even though I haven't been sworn in, I'm actually looking at what my options are to make sure that this doesn't get forced upon our community.
All right, John Lee, the new council member elected this week to represent the 12th LA Council District that covers Chatsworth and Granada Hills and the Northwest Valley. Sir, thank you. Congratulations to you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Well, coming up next, tomorrow would be L.A. poet Charles Bukowski's 99th birthday. We remember the Los Angeles of Bukowski's day as fans eye a bronze statue of him in his beloved San Pedro. You're going to hear about it next on Greater L.A. Thanks for being with us on Greater L.A. I'm your navigator, Steve Chiotakis. The late writer and author Charles Bukowski may have been born in what is now Germany, but the vast majority of his life and prose is very, very L.A. He grew up here. He tore through his eventful life here. He wrote all his poetry and prose here. And he died here more than 25 years ago. But there is an effort now to immortalize his physical being in sculpture in the town where he spent the latter years of his life in Greater L.A. Richard Shave gives historical walking tours all over L.A., including a Charles Bukowski tour called Haunts of a Dirty Old Man. Hey, Richard.
Steve, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
All right. Well, I want to talk about the importance of Bukowski to the city of Los Angeles. What did it give him, and what did he give back?
Charles Bukowski's relationship to Los Angeles changes, and it's chronicled wonderfully in his works, in his early works as this underground poet in the Los Angeles literary scene. He's just very much at Hollywood and Western, amongst the sex shops and the prostitutes and the dive bars and just the ribaldry and the pain and the grief, and he can't escape the haunting beauty, too.
He was also a pretty much well-known alcoholic, had certainly his own demons.
Yes, Charles Bukowski struggled with many demons, but in the end, you know, I think his success and his legacy is that he was really able to tame them.
He lived, Richard, most of his life in East Hollywood, but he eventually moved to San Pedro. That's where he died. Why did he move there?
That's correct. He married his wife Linda in 1984, and she correctly did not want to live in his bungalow apartment in East Hollywood, which was the scene of many fairly desperate scenarios in his life. So they packed up shop and left East Hollywood fuming at the cleanup of Hollywood in anticipation of the Olympics. Charles Bukowski is a prophet in the desert. John the Baptist crying out in the desert in anticipation of what will soon come.
Now community leaders in his adopted neighborhood of San Pedro want to build this bronze statue in his honor. What do you think about that, and what would it look like, do you think?
Well, I think that it's hard to separate Charles Bukowski from bronze busts of him, because so iconically, famously integral to the 1979 novel Women and the myth around his life is the famous Linda King bronze bust, and the ownership of that between Bukowski and King famously indicated whether they were together or apart. So when you say Charles Bukowski and sculpture, I can't but think of Linda King's famous bust. I hope that this proposed statue takes Linda's iconic Bukowski likeness in bronze into account.
What do you think he would say about LA of today, 40 years later?
I don't think he would recognize Hollywood at all today. Hollywood and Western, the sex shops and the dive bars and the hamburger stands that made up his Notes of a Dirty Old Man world, they're all gone. They're all gone, all of them. Even San Pedro, which is really sort of in the background of all of his later writing, but even San Pedro and South Los Angeles is having this wave of development and all of these old iconic places. The Swedish smorgasbord in Torrance is long gone. Alpine Village, the German commercial front market and shopping hub in Torrance is threatened with demolition. These are these iconic places that Bukowski really, really lived in and was Bukowski in, and it's just they're starting to go away. It's very sad.
As we exit the program today, are there any Bukowski lines that you want to share with us? An homage to his Los Angeles.
You know, Charles Bukowski, in order to help the director Barbara Schroeder get the financing for the film Barfly, he gave a series of interviews, and he gave this great interview where he just says again and again and again, there's nowhere to film in East Hollywood anymore. They've locked up the Big 20 like it's a malaria joint. He wonders where all the street life is gone. And he wonders where all the bars that were lively that you had to push your way up to the front to get a beer. And he wonders where all these places have gone now. And I think that's what I'd like people to remember about Charles Bukowski as we look at this rapidly changing Los Angeles streetscape.
LA historian Richard Shave, who gives walking tours through his company called Esoturic, and of course the Charles Bukowski tour as well. Richard, thanks.
Steve, thank you so much for having me.
So So what are your love stories or gripe stories about Greater LA? We'd love to hear from you. Hit us up on our KCRW Twitter or Facebook pages, hashtag it Greater LA. Coming up next, it's the Bookworm who reads you a story. You can hear us anytime at kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Grab the podcast anytime as well. Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, and Christian Bordahl all make this show happen. And so does LA Phil Richards, who engineers this show and who's celebrating a birthday today. Happy birthday, Phil. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Honored by your presence. Thanks for your time and your ear. Have a great day.